You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this session, I'm speaking with Jim Walmsley on spinal immobilisation within practice. So what I thought we'd do is look at some of the historic literature and indeed contemporary literature around spinal immobilisation. Also look at the true prevalence of spinal cord injury versus immobilisation. What we thought we'd also look at is the current recommendations from institutions such as the Royal College of Surgeons Edinburgh and other national recommendations within the UK. I also wanted just to dig into current practice with C-spine collars and indeed where we are at the moment with extrication devices. So to do this, I have Jim Walmsley with me. Jim is a critical care paramedic in South East Coast Ambulance Service within the UK. He has a 19-year history with the Ambulance Service and has focused his career on clinical practice, research, undergraduate teaching, as well as managerial duties. So here is my wide-ranging conversation with Jim Walmsley on spinal immobilisation. Please do enjoy. Welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me along. It's wonderful to be here.
So I wonder if we could just start, Jim, by just asking and maybe exploring just the historic literature and practice of spinal mobilisation up to where we are at the moment.
Absolutely. So I think, if I may, I'll probably bring in the research or the, in my eye, the significant research that is recent and is relevant, certainly for where I work and with what we have put into practice. I think if we look back, and certainly before I even started a career nearly 20 years ago pre-hospitally, I think the focus was for the absolute outcome of what we perceived to feel or think was total immobilization. And this would be done at all costs. And as I'm sure you'll remember, we would do absurd things like what we've called rapid takedowns, where, you know, people who were standing, walking around, maybe asymptomatic, we would suddenly treat them like a porcelain vase, and we can't move them anymore. And this idea of absolute immobilization became the justification. So it's as if, certainly, and this is easy to do with 2020 retrospect vision, but my assessment of what we used to do, what I was asked of me as a clinician, would be to treat these individuals as if we would worsen their injury, whatever the primary insult was, and therefore we can't move them. And in reality, what happened was that we didn't fully immobilize them. We used devices like the KED device, which would immobilize sort of from the head all the way down to the waist, essentially, since sort of being debunked as not being effective. We would put collars on that did not fit correctly back in the day, 20 years ago. We had different sizes, and then came along a collar that you could adjust, and then you would have another collar for pediatrics. But what about, you know, a tiny baby or an adult with no neck? And so some really poor practice essentially became dogma. And we see that around the world. I remember seeing these awful video footage of the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria, and the amazing work that was being done in the aftermath, rescuers very nobly trying to rescue survivors. And it just reminded me how the dogma is so hard to get rid of, and will eat evidence-based medicine for breakfast. And there was a rescuer there with a hard collar, Velcro strapped to the back of his belt on his jeans, ready to be absolutely clamped on to this poor soul that hopefully is rescued. And I think that's you know, the journey that we've had in the UK, certainly within the trust that I work for, I feel very privileged that I feel we're on another step closer to what I hope is the right focus. I think the thing to say is that the evidence is incomplete. There was no evidence before. And then there's been some very important pieces of evidence and research undertaken, with pre-hospital very much in the focus. Nothing to do with in-hospital, but a focus on pre-hospital. And we've got to a point where, while the evidence base is incomplete and it's maybe not the highest level of evidence, we've got some very useful evidence that is supportive of a pragmatic approach. And I think we just have to remember that the whole point of doing this is to be patient focused and what is best for the patient. And I'll share the evidence base that I think is relevant, and I'm sure it can go in the notes after this.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So absolutely, one of the points you make there is around almost this zombie literature, or indeed lack of, and it's a dogma which is sort of being brought through and just almost received without question, I think, from generation to generation, or indeed mentor to mentee. Just looking at the figures of sort of true prevalence of spinal cord injury versus immobilization, I've heard lots of different quotes about sort of 0.5%, 1% of all figures. What in your mind is the true number of spinal cord injury versus immobilized patients that we were seeing before things have started to change?
I don't know if I can answer that accurately. Certainly, some. A webinar that was shared by Motorsport UK that I recently watched and was able to pick up information from is not so sure neither. But what they did say, that they think that around the globe there's probably a million fatalities from RTCs. Of that, in organized license motorsport, is 100 fatalities. Essentially, drilling down and through the numbers, the incident of spinal cord injury from that 100 or from outside that 100 has been virtually nil. That's the difference with organized motorsport, that has more money for funding for research than personal private use of vehicles and the motor industry that make vehicles. But they felt that the occurrence was low. I think I'm reluctant to answer that because if we look at other things like the phenomenon called skewerer or spinal cord injury without radiological abnormality, particularly with pediatrics. This was something that was very much talked about and was a serious concern. But now CT scanning is much more accurate. The quality is much better, and I think it's given that if there are some abnormalities found on CT scan or with signs symptoms, they will go for an MRI. So I think we're much better at detecting. I couldn't give you the numbers. What I would say from my practice, working pre-hospitally, is that the occurrence is very small, as in negligible, for spinal cord injury. There are lots of patients that will have a spinal injury that is the the spine, the skeleton that is around the spinal cord. And an awful lot of those, I learned later, are stable fractures or hairline fractures. So I suppose the thrust of, for me, is that we need to be pragmatic. The evidence base is incomplete. There are some important studies, namely two, really. One's a systematic review, meta-analysis, and another is a Delphi study. And what we're doing in the UK, in the Southeast, as trying to think of the right word, but we're leading by example. We're the guinea pigs. I'm just trying to find the right word for that. But I wonder if that's a better direction of what to talk about.
Absolutely. Well, I think what we'll go and explore now is just around the changing culture and research over the past few years, because I think one of the things me and you have both seen really is, you know, this as advanced practice has started to mature and we're starting to get sort of 5, 6, 7 years down the line, one of the pillars of advanced practice, pre-hospital care, paramedic practice, is research. And we're starting to also see the fruition of MSCs. So there's lots more people who have got MSCs, who have qualified with an MSC, publishing their research, their dissertation. And with the proliferation of research comes sort of more diagnostic ability to drill down into the evidence base to look at the true prevalence. But so could you maybe speak to your perspective on the changing culture and indeed the increase in research within pre-hospital care?
I think what's been really nice is that back in 2012, the Royal College of Surgeons, essentially, Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh, started to push forward to gain consensus. That eventually led to a Delphi study, which is probably the first significant piece of evidence base that I think should be taken seriously. And essentially that got together a group of stakeholders who are at the top of the game, are very involved pre-hospitally, whether that be from a HEM service or an advanced paramedic perspective, through to clinicians that have knowledge on the injury profile and what is seen after investigation and diagnosis. And I think what that study really has been encouraging to do has been to support this very idea that while the evidence base is incomplete, while some of it is not level one evidence base, we should really take a pragmatic approach, because what we have done previously has caused more harm. What we do know from other groups like Motorsport UK is that trying to immobilize someone, particularly when extricating, almost certainly does more movement than if a patient, an individual, can look after themselves and extricate with care. They can do less movement for themselves. That only speaks for the patients that are conscious, that are alert, don't have a distracting injury, are not intoxicated, and are able to assimilate the information we would give for them, for us to assess whether that would be safe and appropriate. However, saying that, I think that's really encouraged us to understand with other pieces of evidence that has looked at motion of bodies, individuals, when they've been extricated, and that being documented in an evidence base, that we know that trying to take over what an individual can do is probably going to cause more movement. So I think that's the first study that or has been one of the first binding studies in the most recent last couple of years that has been really useful. The thread and the core through all of this is that no one is ruling out a spinal cord injury or a cervical injury. This is not about having a silver bullet, a panacea, which really probably people want. So we can decide whether, you know, for the more minor injury or the more minor incidents, can we discharge on scene and send home safely? Or should we take into hospital for further investigation? Or should we take into hospital immobilized? And from that study, really, the things that were agreed was a common terminology, what the goal should be for extrication, what the approach should be, and how we should manage patients who do require management, i.e. immobilization. That is to say, if we are to immobilize, we should look to fully immobilize the whole of the head, neck, and spine. And that invariably involves some kind of, well, certainly pre-hospitally, we advocate a orthopedic scoop, what would be commonly known as a Furno scoop, where they can stay on that for a longer period of time. So we have a travel isochrone of an hour. We're happy for patients to stay on that scoop for up to an hour. Blocks, tape, and then straps fully immobilized down. And there are various techniques as to how to use those straps.
Now, I think what we'll do is we'll actually look at the recommendations on spinal immobilization shortly, actually, because I think that it's important to, as you quite rightly said, look at sort of the pragmatic indicators for immobilization versus the sort of formulaic ones or historic ones. So we'll visit that question. But I just wanted to sort of pause really and just go back to one of the questions, or indeed the statements you made earlier around unintended effects of immobilization, and indeed the sort of second and third order effects of immobilization when it's not needed. Could you maybe speak to the what immobilization can do if we're not really truly thinking about mechanism, about some of the concepts we all speak to shortly, and indeed some of the risk factors? What are some of the issues that the immobilization, poorly applied or indeed poorly attributed immobilization, could cause?
So I think while some might take this as encouragement or a reason to proceed or an excuse to proceed, we do know that incorrectly sized immobilization techniques do cause harm, damage, and even iatrogenic treatment. So if we take the collar, we know that the collar often is mal-sized, mal-placed, deeply uncomfortable, causes more pain, more duress, more stress. It can actually constrict blood flow to the brain. So if we're then and or worried about a head injury, are we worsening what we would call a traumatic brain injury or a concern for traumatic brain injury? And we know that the brain is very fickle, particularly after a primary insult, it needs to have the right amount of oxygen, the right amount of blood pressure, the right amount of glucose, etc. So we know that it can cause human and equipment factors and errors when we might need to do other interventions like an anesthetic while trying to immobilize and keep an individual as best immobilized as possible. We know that it can delay care or delay intervention. So from professionals to lay people, certainly particularly lay people, they worry deeply that moving a patient might cause a spinal cord injury, and a detrimental one, that one that cannot be reversed, and therefore they freeze and will not sort of look after life over limb. And we see that, or we did see that certainly in professional groups, where there was this idea that if you just applied a collar, if you applied some blocks, then it was fine and it was covered and you couldn't be blamed for any secondary injury. We know that patients who might have more than one injury, so we might be concerned for a statistically low chance of a spinal cord or a high spinal cord injury, they may have other injuries like a flail chest, for example. And actually, in fact, with proper assessment, if you can rule out that on clinical assessment and probability, this is a there might be a chance for a fracture or a spinal cord injury, certainly a spinal fracture, but it's a stable spinal fracture, we will have different priorities. For example, we might want to sit them straight up and deal with an airway and breathing priorities rather than trying to immobilize them. We knew that we were fully immobilizing people at the expense of all other care that an individual might need. We know that in the past, and we know from evidence base, that just putting a collar on or a collar and blocks and tape isn't enough because people will move around from the neck and down. We've all seen, or we've probably seen GIFs, photos of these collars being moved so that they're a lovely blind to be able to sleep in an A&E departments, or they've been poorly placed so the chin support, which on a lot of collars you have to flip out, is still in, so that's causing even more pain, damage and harm. We know that in the past we used to have metal scoops, and we worried about coagulopathy and temperature. We know that they can't stay on these scoops for a prolonged period of time because they will have secondary injuries that might seem benign, like a pressure sore or an ulcer, but if not treated, if not recognized, will then become problems. So those are some of the things that we know can cause harm. This, the idea of immobilization being risk-free, error-free, and is 100% positive for an individual is a misconcept, really.
So Jim, just looking at the sort of, we'll get onto the assessment shortly, but could you maybe speak to your practice, sort of what your, so contemporary practice within London and indeed within sort of the south of England is we've really migrated away from collars, and because of a number of aspects which you've already mentioned, but sort of this venous drainage being a big one. So from concomitant head injury, having having the pressure around the back of the neck where the ventricles drain, and the tightness of the collar, it can increase ICP actually, so it can increase intracerebral pressure. Could you speak to your practice? Because again, what we're doing right now is just using blanket rolls or indeed head blocks without a collar. And indeed, if they've got a head injury, we're elevating the bed up to 30 degrees to promote venous drainage. What's your practice?
We're very lucky in the southeast where I work, and particularly within the program that I work as a specialist paramedic in critical care. Back in 2020, one of our seniors, Alan Cowley, started and spearheaded and put into practice a new way of assessing and managing and immobilizing patients. And that has been a real success from what we can tell. I must underline, this is still very much with an approach that if we have a concern for a spinal cord injury or a spinal injury, then we will seek to immobilize fully and to the best of our ability. What we have done is we have taken away cervical collars from frontline pre-hospital ambulance led care. They're still available with HEM systems where they might need to pack hemorrhagic airway compromise, Lafaur fractures being an obvious example. But we've taken away from our practice, and we feel from the evidence base that putting the collar or not putting a collar on does not make any difference, but putting a collar on can cause a lot of these issues that you've spoken about and I've brought up. So what we do is we have a simple assessment process whereby we will decide whether the patient is 65 or older or younger. And that's not to say that 65 is a significant age for frailty, comorbidity, or indeed an objective decision. But the evidence base suggests that from the age of 65 and older, individuals are at more risk of comorbidity and or complications like osteoporosis, as one example. So we might have a 50-year-old that's comorbid and we would treat them the same as the 65 or older. But we essentially use a combination of the Nexus spinal immobilization guidelines and Canadian C-spine guidelines. And depending on, firstly, our assessment of whether this is a patient at risk of comorbidity, frailty, will depend on how we then further assess. Essentially, we ask ourselves a series of questions that start with a mechanism. And again, a mechanism does not need to be an absolute. So I attended an incident last week with a car that lost control off the motorway at high speed, rolled, witnessed to roll the car roll 8 to 9, 10 times. Essentially, long story short, the driver, the only occupant, was stood upright with the car sideways up in an embankment, and we could not get to him because the windscreen was intact and all of that internal space of the car was, the front of the car was written off, and essentially there was no engine bay. And the mechanism would be what we would class or consider to be severe, a high-speed mechanism, high impact, high energy. But he was an individual that while I could not get eyes on, hands on, effectively, I could do enough of an assessment through the windscreen that was not completely opaque. It was still in place and intact. And there was a gap between the door. So the door would open up like this for me to ask him relevant questions. And he was able to guide me for my initial management and how I was wanting fire rescue and as well as HEMS to support me. He essentially on assessment had pain in his nose, no other distracting injury, was standing and had been standing on the ground. Because if you imagine the car, but on its side, and he's then stood in that space, guided me to actually instruct fire rescue to be able to get him out under urgent principles, but not time critical or life threatening. So let's take our time. We know that cutting glass or smashing glass, is they call it the glass asbestosis. It's a new asbestosis risk. So if we can, we don't want to do that. And so it gave me reassurance that we weren't in a life-threatening or time-critical situation, that I could pass over to my fire rescue specialist colleagues who do what they do best and our specialists to get this man for me to then get eyes on, hands on, a proper primary survey or a proper primary assessment to then decide he is safe and appropriate to walk down the embankment to then lay down on a stretcher for us to do a much more detailed secondary survey with clothes cut off. So we have a new set of guidelines that guide us that's from what is the mechanism to then making a series of further questions and assessments. And they essentially group around, is there a distracting injury or injuries? Are they alert, aware, orientated, i.e. not suffering with a head injury, however minor to severe, that they are not intoxicated, and that there is no altered neurology, whether that be central spinal pain, crepitus, deformity, and altered neurology, a bit like we would consider around caudal equina syndrome. So some of these more subtle altered neurology signs that the individual could tell us about. If there's any inability to make that assessment, we move towards a full immobilization. For patients where we can't fully immobilize, so definitely on the comorbid side of the algorithm, individuals, as an example, that have kyphosis or scoliosis, but certainly kyphosis, curvature of the spine, where they're not able to lay flat on a scoop, or we might cause more harm, we will definitely more cause more harm by trying to strap them down. So I'm thinking a worst case scenario might be a very small child who has a confirmed traumatic brain injury from witnessed events, clinical examination and assessments, is agitated, needs an anaesthetic, or we need to get them into a hospital for an anaesthetic and further investigation. We might be able to sedate these individuals before immobilizing. We might not be able to. So patients where we feel that we're going to cause harm, but we still are worried that they might have a spinal injury from a professional clinical assessment and assessment of the scene and the mechanism, we use a lanyard system. So we put a lanyard around them that says C-spine not cleared. Because for many years, this was the argument, particularly from colleagues in hospital who really insisted that we carried on using collars, because they were a label that was a very clear label and a very useful label to say that individual has not had their spine cleared by assessment and or investigation.
Jim, could you just maybe speak to some of the subtle signs on scene? You've already mentioned mechanism of injury. You've already mentioned comorbidities, and indeed the age cutoffs. And it is an amalgamation, like you said, of the Canadian C-spine rules and the National Emergency X-ray Utilization Study, the NEXUS study, to come to sort of this sensible, pragmatic approach.
Reading from the spinal immobilization guidelines that we have, and excuse me while I don my glasses, I'll just very much accurately list out what we would assess. Now, this is for patients that are essentially under 65, that are at much less risk of an injury. And so we consider seriously the mechanism and take that into account. And if we think that it's been a dangerous mechanism, or there is some sort of parathesia, then we will seek to fully immobilize, and we don't assess any further. We just move immediately to seek to fully immobilize. And we can do real subtle things that work well, like manual inline stabilization or mobile inline stabilization. If we're happy with no gross altered neurology, we will then decide, particularly if it's a minor mechanism, have they been ambulatory at any point at any time? If that's a yes, then that encourages to move to the next step. Is there an absence of midline spinal tenderness, crepitus or deformity? And that there's been no delayed onset of central neck pain. If that's the case, we essentially cut to speak to see if they can then rotate their head 45 degrees to a left and right plane and flex and extend to see if they can do that movement without having altered neurology signs or symptoms. Having said that, if there is concern for a spinal injury, we would not do any of that, and we would immobilize and get them into hospital for further investigation. The others simply are that there mustn't be an intoxication of any kind. There mustn't be a head injury of any kind. There mustn't be a distracting injury of any kind. And that they're the main principles, really. On the other side, where we consider a patient from their health status, comorbidity status, again, we consider mechanism, but we particularly take into account age or frailty. Is there any altered neurology, trauma to the head or distracting injury? Do they have pre-existing spinal concerns, which again would fit into our healthier group? So if someone has had spinal surgery before or a spinal injury before, then we would seek to fully immobilize. So typically a horse rider that's fallen off, broken their back, quote unquote. When you hear that, that's just an immediate go-to to fully immobilize. I think some of the more subtle signs that you could be remiss to miss are whereby maybe an individual is intoxicated or difficult, or are they coming across difficult? And certainly I went to an individual recently that they were quite a cheeky chappy, and you know, they didn't want to really engage with me. They didn't want to be particularly assessed. They certainly didn't want to want to be taken to hospital. It was in at the middle of the evening, so in the UK over winter, pitch dark, pitch black. I work on a what we call a single response vehicle, on a fast car, waiting for a double crewed ambulance or a big ambulance to come and support me, where we have an environment where we can do more in-depth assessment and investigation. And he didn't want to engage with me. And I just got the impression that he was just a bit of a cheeky chappy, and he was just, you know, he was just a bit of an awkward character. It just so happened to be that with time, which was, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, when we got him onto the ambulance and laid him on the ambulance stretcher to then do a full secondary survey, a more detailed clinical assessment and examination, he started having some subtle signs. So he started to show signs of short-term amnesia. He had a change in his pupils. He had a bit of tenderness, but he shrugged it off to his neck. And we chose to fully immobilize him. And it turned out that he had a stable fracture of his spine, and he had a minor traumatic brain injury that was conservatively managed.
Thanks for that. That's nice and sequential. And actually, like you said, you know, really pragmatic in a way, that allows you to start. It's kind of, you know, ruling out as opposed to ruling in, and then but looking to see where. It's the global picture as well. So it's the mechanism of injury. I think something that I became acutely aware of is that the driver compartment of a car, it takes some real force to bend a steering wheel, or indeed to where, you know, where's the dashboard? Where's the steering wheel compared to the patient? Is there any thoracic injury? Is there any, and indeed from the external, if it's a pedestrian, is there any A-post damage, subtle A-post damage, or indeed bonnet damage to the bonnet? Is the bullseye an internal bullseye or an external bullseye really important? Is there any hair in that bullseye? Is there anything to suggest that that's a head that's gone, that's made that dent, or indeed that damage? It's always difficult when you're the only person on scene, but if you do have chance to go back and have a look at the scene, I very much was mentored to try and take that time to really get a semblance of the mechanism, because it's not always apparent straight away, but can really lead you down these, to your point, these subtleties of injury patterns.
Absolutely. And I think we don't talk about it much, but it's something that that was revised again, me listening to some of this work done by Motorsport UK, that the direction and the type of vehicle, so the direction of that impact, the speed, what was the stopping distance, because that energy has to go somewhere. And if it can't be dissipated, it will go through into the body and be dissipated. Again, we know that a side impact, you could reinforce a car to the strength of a tank, and there still would be intrusion, and certainly enough energy that would intrude that would cause significant injury. So we know that a side impact takes much less energy, much less speed, much less impact to have a significant impact on injury patterns and injuries sustained, both externally and internally, obviously, and this idea of organs that either shear because they dangle, or they tear because they're locked in within the body is significant. Whereas an impact coming from front to yourself or to the individual being assessed normally is, you can take a higher impact at a higher speed. Having said that, the vehicle must have some kind of ability to absorb and take in that energy. And while some of the modern cars are phenomenal, and we know, you know, some are better than others, and the safety standard that they engineer in, if you're in a 1920s car, which is an incident I remember going to, and the steering wheel is literally broken, and they're complaining of abdominal pain, you have to assume they have significant injury until otherwise proven, because these are vehicles that have improper systems. And again, also, you know, like you're saying, that collateral history, getting that information, understanding where they were in a seatbelt, where were they sat within that vehicle, where was the impact to that vehicle, is all very important.
So Jim, as we're coming to land on the conversation, could you maybe just speak to some take-home messages for listeners that you'd like to mention?
I think my first take-home message ties into what we've just spoken about, and I think you cannot underestimate what I would call that end of bed assessment, that end of scene assessment. As you're approaching in, you know, one of the many reasons why we don't run to a scene is that we just are taking information in, and I cannot overestimate how useful that is. And it just gives you such valuable information, and we're able to assimilate an awful lot of information, and normally subconsciously, particularly with experience, and you pick up on these signs and factors that have we know in from previous incidents have been significant. We often look up our work and try and learn from what the scene was like, or the vehicle, to what the injury patterns were. So I think that would be my first take-home message, is you cannot overestimate, and you will be dragged in, or you may be dragged in. I remember an incident a couple of years ago where a fellow professional on scene prior to me from another service literally was trying to drag me towards a minor injured patient to assess them, because they were very vocal and they were making a lot of noise. And I knew that actually I'd been sent to deal with a much more critically unwell and injured individual. So do take that time. The second take home would be, don't fall into the trap of wanting to, thinking to, or trying to rule out spinal injury or spinal cord injury. That is for time, further investigation, fresh eyes, and advanced technology that we just do not have pre-hospitally to assess these patients. So I think you almost have to look at it in a different way. You have to piece together objective information as to why you are not going to immobilize this patient, this individual, or individuals. And certainly, a lot of services and systems are under pressure. So if we've got multiply injured patients, it might be a field that you need to try and sort of downgrade or reduce the limited resource that we would have to that scene. So think, why is it that I'm not going to immobilize this patient? The next thing I'd say is work to a scaffold, work to a system, work to something that will work for you at 4 in the morning or 4 in the afternoon, because you will be swayed by behavior, by attitude, by the cortisone levels in your blood, by, you know, you wanting to get home on time or whatever it might be. So by following a structure and a process, you've got less chance of making subjective decisions and assessments. And again, this is a language, this is something that you can use with your colleagues. You can go, you know, to a colleague, this is where I'm coming from. Can we work through this together? Mechanism, are we agreed that it is or is not significant? And then lastly, I would say primary survey, secondary surveys, or what we would call primary survey, secondary survey. So do a very detailed primary survey, assessing the patient in entirety, top to bottom, front and back. We talk about having blue paint on our hands and trying to turn our patients into Smurfs. People have heard this before, but we're trying to turn them into Smurfs for very good reason, because if they've got distracting injuries, are they a higher priority to manage over spinal immobilization? Or is it that actually in totality, you can understand what the order of priorities are and the work stream of what you need to consider? And then look for a full secondary survey wherever you can. And that can't be rushed. That can't be sort of done as a shortcut. You will have to cut clothes off wherever it's appropriate and with consent. Or on behalf of the individual. You will have to do proper assessments. So, you know, being able to assess a pelvis as to whether that's fractured or not in an accurate way is a big difference to just putting your hands on and just seeing if there's a bit of symmetry or not. Because if you understand that you've got a concern for a fractured pelvis, well, if a significant girdle bone is fractured, and remember that's like a polo mint, they never break in one place. Thinking about the spine, you know, that's at much higher risk. Certainly, the thinner it gets closer to the head. So, they would be the take homes, and you will have colleagues that will insist and push dogma through, and there will be colleagues who will insist that you don't need to.
Jim, I think that's fantastic. And I think from a just sequentially, I think that's a great checklist to check off. And as you quite rightly, as you said, I think human factors play a large part in it. And actually having that scaffold or indeed system, which mitigates the human factors at 4 in the morning, and you can still stick by some consistent framework that you can adhere to, irrespective of day or night, 12 hours, 13 hours into the shift. So I think that's fantastic. Listen, what we'll do is put in the show notes some of the recommendations that you speak of, the Royal College of Surgeons and indeed others, and just give people frames of reference to refer back. But I just want to thank you for your last hour, Jim. It's fantastic getting your knowledge and indeed your experience. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Owen. It's been a real pleasure, and look forward to a catch-up next time.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.